You have 24 minutes. You have 24 minutes, the podcast from 24 Hour Nation. 24 Hour Nation's website, podcast, and webinars will introduce you to nighttime thought leaders who can help you help your city be safer, more dynamic, and more respectful at night. We also share global news, reports, and educational opportunities that benefit nighttime influencers in American cities. In addition, 24 Hour Nation presents new and intriguing things to see and do at night across the USA. My name is Randall White, host and curator for 24 Hour Nation. Find us online at 24hournation.com and on social media at 24 Hour Nation. Today, we spend a delightful 24 minutes with Carly Heath, nighttime economy advisor for the Bristol City Council in the UK. We will talk about Bristol, her role, their innovative programs to address drink spiking and sexual harassment in the nighttime space, the responsibility on developers who benefit from creating residences near nightlife districts, we're going there, and we discuss climate change and the night. Wow. Learn what your town or city could also be championing as we spend 24 minutes with Carly Heath.
So Bristol's nightlife, we really do punch above our weight for a city our size. You know, in the past, we've kind of given birth to acts like Massive Attack, Ronnie Size Represent. Most recently, we've got a very cool punk pop band called Idols that are doing really big, making really big waves internationally. But we've got lots of very small venues. You know, lots of our venues are maybe 100 capacity, 150 capacity, 300 capacity. Our biggest venue is 3,000 people. So we're actually quite small. But because of that collection of smaller venues, it means that there's an opportunity for communities to grow within those and for ideas to spread and for people to actually experiment and put on nights. So we're really good at being able to sort of test the water and try things new. We've got a lot of electronic music in Bristol, a lot of jungle, drum and bass, dubstep. Bristol's a bit of a soulful home of dubstep, you know, house music, techno, all of the genres, we will have them here. And this, it doesn't, music really is actually part of the fabric of the city of nightlife in Bristol. But nightlife isn't just about music, right? It's not just about music culture. It's also pubs, clubs, bars, restaurants, all of those kinds of places. We've got a really good food game in Bristol. We've got lots of micro restaurants where we'll probably only have about 10, 15 covers in it. And you've got to book days in advance to even be able to get into them. And every single restaurant is a bit like, you know, is booked way in advance. So we have a very healthy, flourishing food scene here. And as a really friendly kind of vibesy city, it's really easy to just get about and feel like you're at home, even just on your first visit.
Well, now I want to make my first visit. So so what inspired the Bristol City Council to create the position of a nighttime economy advisor?
In the UK, we don't have many nighttime advisors. I'm the third one to exist. So we have Amy LeMay in London. We have Sasha Lord in Manchester. And now me for Bristol. The culture of Bristol's nightlife is so much of the fabric of its city. And there's some common problems that need resolving, you know, whether that's nighttime safety, whether that's looking after the workforce, whether that's making sure that the workforce are paid a decent wage. You know, there's some common problems that need to happen. For a city like Bristol, 30% of our population work between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. So it's not an insignificant amount of people. Part of those within the hospitality sector and the visitor economy, but also a large part of those are actually just people that need to work within the city at night. So that's late night retail, health and social care, transportation, 24-hour call centres, all of those kinds of places. The working docks, of course, the 24 hours. So we've got lots of nighttime workers who are often not considered when it comes to matters of public policy, or not as considered as they could be. So Bristol City Council recognised that there was a need to be able to think about nightlife and the nighttime workforce with a bit more attention. And when met the Mayor Marvin Rees, he set up the first iteration of the night panel, which was before my time, and asked nighttime representatives from all across the sector, whether that's licensing, planning, you know, pub groups and restaurant associations, all of that kind of stuff, to come together to kind of solve some of the problems. And then COVID hit. So COVID obviously completely wiped the floor with our industry. There was lots of problems, and it was a constantly moving target with how to resolve this. But what we were able to do within that time is actually really kind of get together between the council and the people that work within the industry to have a constant communication about how to make nightlife spaces safe, right? And they really recognised throughout that process that it would be beneficial for there to be a person whose job it is to try and advocate for the night and to try and do that sort of facilitation of bringing all the people together to solve some of these common problems. Thankfully, we're now out of the major restrictions from COVID. Hopefully those won't be coming back, but we're certainly feeling the impacts of what that lockdown did to our sector. But the good thing that has come out of it is actually, because we're such a small city, we do all talk to each other. And my job really is to sit somewhere in between industry and policy and help to kind of bring people to the table to talk about what some of our common difficulties are.
Tell us about you and how you were the right fit for this this task.
So I've been working in nightlife my entire life. You know, I put my first party on when I was 13. When I first moved, I, you know, hired a club and got all my friends down. I've probably put on thousands of parties in my time. I've worked in the smallest venues in town and the biggest venues in town. I used to run a promotions company called Don't Panic, which was a brown paper flyer pack stuffed with flyers and stickers and freebies and things like that. This is pre-Facebook days. I'm probably showing my age here, but you know, what you used to do to be able to promote everybody's nights was stand outside at 3 o'clock in the morning handing out flyers. And that's really where I cut my teeth. I spent 10 years standing outside at 3 o'clock in the morning on the mean streets of Bristol. So I literally have got that lived experience of what happens at that time of day. But I've also been part of setting up a community festival called BrizFest that ran for a number of years. I've had record labels, I've run club nights, I've kind of done a bit of everything, really. So I've got quite a broad view. There probably isn't a job in nightlife that I haven't tried at least once, whether that's working on the cloakroom or being an artist liaison or standing outside flying or whatever it is. So I've got I know the city and the city's music scene very, very well when it comes to the cultural landscape.
Well, you've talked a little bit about your role is to talk because you are able to talk to each other in a city the size of Bristol. But tell us a little bit more about your liaison role with the city government, as well as with the stakeholders in the city. And what's your job? Tell us, give me an insight about that.
I'll give you a really good example. And that's the work we've been doing around drink spiking. Right. Drink spiking is one of those issues. There is legislation against it. It is a crime. It's a very tricky problem to tackle because without evidence that you need to be able to, for the police to be able to gather, to be able to make a prosecution, prosecutions are generally very, very low when it comes to the crime of drink spiking. But it is something that happens in nightlife spaces. It's woefully underreported. So I don't know whether you've ever been spiked or whether you've ever witnessed anyone being spiked, but it's one of those things that actually it should be a problem for all of us to solve, right? So I spoke to a number of different venues about what their drink spiking policies were, about what their needs were, to try and kind of identify where those common threads are. Like if we tackle a problem like drink spiking, and we tackle it as a citywide issue, how can we help the industry to protect the audiences whilst also helping the police to gather the information to catch perpetrators, right? Because at the end of the day, I want to see people actually arrested and brought to justice for poisoning other people when they're on a night out. I think it's a despicable behaviour. So how do we do that? We do that through collaboration, really. So we spoke to a wide range of venues and we set up a partnership between the Business Improvement District, the BID, Bristol City Council and Avon and Somerset Police to first of all, we spent about 6 months trying to unpick what the problems were, whether that's the cataloguing of the crime on the police side of things, whether that's the on the venue side of things, them not wanting to raise their head above the parapet in case they've got, in case they're seen to have a problem, whether that's on the public side of things, people actually just not thinking anybody's going to do anything about it or that they care. And I used to see lots of advice around about things like don't leave your drink unattended. And I think that that's bad advice, really, because that is, you're saying to people, don't get poisoned. It's kind of victim blaming language, right? Mm. It shouldn't be about don't leave your drink unattended and watch who you know, aren't your friends, aren't really your friends and stuff like that. I don't agree that that's the right message. It's that what was she wearing kind of message.
And really,
the only person whose fault it is for a drink spiking incident is the person that put the thing in the drink in the first place, the perpetrator. It's their fault. So how can we work together as a community of businesses and a community of nightlife practitioners and audiences to make sure that we're all looking out for each other, but actually having a zero tolerance to drink spiking incidences within the city? So what we did as a response to that is we at Bristol City Council, the police and the BIDs funded drinks testing kits. So we provided the venues with drinks testing kits. 157 venues are now signed up to this scheme. They've all got drinks testing kits behind the bar. If somebody thinks that their drink has been tampered with, they can go to the bar and it can be tested there and then. Alongside that, we did a public facing campaign about what to do with if you get spiked. Crucially, if the police are going to get the forensics from it, they need to test the person who has been spiked within as little as 12 hours because the drugs start to leave the system. So to get that forensics evidence, that early evidence gathering is really, really key to make it to be able to have a prosecution. So we needed to get that message out to the public, but we also needed to make sure that the venues were all singing to the same hymn sheet. You know, if somebody isn't feeling very well, we don't want them to throw them out onto the harbour side where they have to find their own way home. We want to make sure that they're looked after and that there's a network of people that are all going to look after somebody in that vulnerable state. So it becomes a place of audience, you know, care at the same time. Plus, we're a harbour city. People tragically fall in the river on a night out sometimes and don't get back out again. So we have this duty of care has got so many different layers about making sure that we keep people safe. But we have made real inroads. You know, we one of the main things that we wanted to do with this campaign was actually increase reporting. And reporting has gone up dramatically. Lots of people will look at that and say, well, Bristol isn't very safe because the data looks like we've got a massive drink spiking problem. But actually, we've just exposed what was already there, and we're talking about it openly. And by making sure that the data is robust, it means that the police put the right resources into it to be able to tackle this issue seriously. So
I'm not aware of any other city anywhere doing this. Are you? At this degree?
To the degree that we're doing it, we modelled it on a number of different places. Devon and Cornwall, which is further down south from Bristol, did a pilot version of this in 2019. And we borrowed the modelling from there, but we expanded it. And then we also provided the venue process guide that we created to help venues read through it. We wrote it for nightlife people and not like it looks like it came out of the local authority. So
very
the actual
nice.
Tone and messaging, it's colourful, it's vibrant, it's quick and snappy. It doesn't look like a policy document.
Very nice. You're considering your audience. You use the phrase duty of care. Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if somebody falls unconscious inside your nightclub, I suppose one of the old ways of dealing with it is ejecting them from the building and then they're not your problem anymore. And that's from a harm reduction perspective, that's not what we want people to be doing. We want people to actually make sure that they're okay, make sure that they've got a planned journey home, make sure that they're at not risk of harm to themselves, but seek medical attention for them if it's necessary. You know, nightlife is about creating warm and magical spaces for people to be able to enjoy themselves and let go of the troubles of the day, right? If somebody isn't feeling very well, we've got a duty to look after them and make sure that they don't cause themselves harm.
Very nice. Very nice. And I have to tell you, again, I follow everything that's going on around the world, and I have not seen anybody throw their energy at these kind of social programs in terms of a nighttime economy as I've seen in Bristol. Your drinks biking program, and also talk to me a little bit about what you're doing in terms of sexual harassment.
Yeah. So we actually borrowed from Amy LeMay in London. She released a women's safety charter a number of years ago, which essentially is 7 commitments to prioritising women's safety in a nightlife setting. The first step is to appoint a champion, to have somebody that everybody can go to if a sexual harassment or sexual assault behaviour has been noticed or notified. The second is to communicate clearly, to have a communications campaign that is positive in language, is non-judgmental, you know, and let your audiences know that you care about women's safety and that your staff are trained to be able to deal with it. Then training is a huge part of this as well. Train your staff to identify what sexually harassing behaviours are, but also how to receive those reports of it. And then we ask nighttime businesses to audit their spaces. So to have a look at their spaces, identify where those dark corners might be, and to think about it through a lens of women's safety, and think about, well, maybe we'll place a security camera there, or we'll light it up, or we'll put a security guard there, or whatever. Now, nightlife spaces change all the time, right? Depending on what you've got in the venue that night, you know, you might bring in some plants and that creates a whole new dark space in the corner. So like we do things like we get these venues to... We put out a venue heat map guide. So when the show changes the structure of the venue, that heat map guide can become something which is used as part of the briefing session at the beginning of the night for staff that are coming in for that night. So we recognize that it's constantly changing and constantly evolving within these spaces. And we try and give the tools for organizations to be able to deal with this. Now, with that Women's Safety Charter, we're asking people to go through some quite embedded training around sexual harassment and sexual assault. And when we were doing the research for this piece of work, we spoke to over 200 people within Bristol that work or have nightlife businesses or are patrons of the night. And over 100% of the women that we spoke to could name a sexually harassing experience that they had experienced within a nightlife setting. Over half of the men that we spoke to couldn't even name what a sexually harassing behaviour was. So we recognised that we actually needed to raise the baseline of understanding across the whole sector. We developed an anti-sexual harassment training course, and we did this specifically for nightlife settings. And we did it for the front of house, right? What I would possibly class the dance floor economy. So it's the people that walk the floor. It's the people that see audiences interacting with each other. It's those that can spot those moments. So it's for bar staff, security, promoters, performers, stagehands, you know, anybody that might be able to intervene in those moments. And we give them bystander training. We let them know what those sexually harassing behaviours are. But we also think about it through an intersectional lens as well. We think about intersectionality, and we think about how people of colour might experience a sexually harassing episode compounded by their, you know, by their self-identifying markers. We also talk about how people from the LGBTQIA community might be impacted, and also people with disabilities, whether they're physical or mental or you know, visual impairments and those sorts of things, and how they might add another layer, and try and actually get people to understand that when somebody comes forward to declare that person over there is being a creep, that there's a sensitive way in which you need to deal with that situation. So we try and train people to be able to deal with that, to try and really actually have a bit of a zero tolerance to sexual harassment within our nightlife settings within the city. So the city doesn't stop at 6 o'clock, you know. That nighttime economy is where we meet our friends, is where we meet our families. I fully believe that nighttime is the heart and soul of our communities. You know, it's where the city gets to live. It's where the city gets to flourish. And for a city like Bristol, we've got two really big universities here. We have a lot of people that move to the city for the culture. Right. And it's really at the heart of what it is to be a Bristolian, is part of our nighttime economy. So it's good that we get to kind of bring them all in together. In a city like Bristol, we've got a lot of development going on. We've got a lot of gentrification going on, and we are quite a small city, so everything's on top of each other. I don't know a single venue in Bristol that doesn't have a development going on right next door to it. But we've got a thing in the UK called agent change principle. Now, that principle actually started in Bristol.
And it started. Describe that. I'm familiar with that, but a lot of folks aren't. And when I bring that up in the States, some people bristle at the idea of agent of change.
Yeah.
Explain that.
So agent of change is when you've got a commercial developer coming in next door to a nightlife space who wants to take an old office building and turn it into luxury flats. You know, what they do is they put the building up. They don't insulate it properly. They don't put the proper windows in it. They don't put the proper soundproofing in it. And then residents move into the area and close down the venue next door that's been there for 30 years. And we've seen it all over the country. In the, we've lost an enormous amount of venues and pubs in the last 10, 15 years in the UK. I can't remember the stats off the top of my head. This is terrible, isn't it? But we've lost a significant portion of our nighttime culture. An agent of change really is to, it kind of was that moment where it's like, agent of change is that moment where it's like, enough is enough. If somebody's moving into the area because it's a nice quiet back street and they're like, oh, this looks like a good place for a residential building, it's up to that developer to put the work in, to put the soundproofing in, to make sure that the right amount of sound readings have been done on a busy night for the clubs, right? What we were seeing is people were coming through and they were doing a sound reading outside the club on a Tuesday afternoon when the venue's shut, you know. So we're saying, well, that's ridiculous because you're planning for a quiet road. But when it comes to Saturday night at 11 o'clock, midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning, that soundscape completely changes and your residents are just going to complain to the venue. So it's not up to the existing venue to put the work in to be able to soundproof their venue, limit their smoking gardens, you know, turn down their sounds. You've also got things like dray vans and deliveries and, you know, all of the load in and load out of equipment, sound checks, all of those kinds of things. A venue is a noisy space. And if you're going to put a building up right next door to a noisy space, you are the agent of change. You're the one that's doing something different in the area. And it's up to you to soundproof your building and make sure that that venue is protected. And the way in which that we do that is both through trying to be really rigorous through the planning system and make sure that they've developers have really considered the existing venue next door, but also to put in what we call a deed of easement into any residents that go into that building. So when they move in, they sign a piece of paper saying they can't complain about the noise from the venue next door because they've moved in next to a pub or a club or a bar or a restaurant, whatever it is. They knew what they were moving in next to. So it's kind of it's not a perfect system, but it's the system that we've got. And it's the way in which that we try to protect venues in a city. I mean, I know in the States you have lots of zoned areas when it comes to nightlife. We don't. We're a radial city, meaning that we've got the heart of the city centre and then lots of main roads that come off it like a wheels, like, you know, spikes of a bike wheel. And there is nightlife up every single road. You know, there's a pub down every street corner. So we are, nightlife is absolutely everywhere, but it's embedded into the city. And it shouldn't be up to developers to be able to capitalise from these great, great locations and then nightlife have to pay for their bad planning.
I can't wait to share that with a few folks in the States. So we're talking with Carly Heath, who's the Nighttime Economy Advisor in Bristol, UK, works for the Bristol City Council. You can learn more about the programs in Bristol at their website, bristolnights.co.uk. They're also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Bristol Nights HQ and on LinkedIn at Bristol Nights. There are so many things we could talk about, Carly. I had more questions I wanted to ask you. I wanted to ask you about where's your energy going to go next?
I've been in my position for just over a year and a half, and we've been dealing with reopening and all of the fallout from that. But really, there's so much more, I think, that we could do. And we're a workforce that's woefully under-supported. So I want to do work around looking after the mental health and wellness of the workforce. We are an industry that does have a lot of alcohol and also drugs within the system. I would like to do much more work around harm reduction to make sure that people are safe and looked after. And also really around climate you know, climate action and climate change and sustainability. The city doesn't stop at 6 o'clock and the climate crisis doesn't either. We've got so much work to do to as cities, and cities are going to be at the cutting edge of being able to tackle the climate crisis, right? And nightlife is the heart of why we live in cities in the first place. We've got food and hospitality with huge amounts of energy uses, but also food waste. We've got a really good opportunity to work within the circular economy within those movements, have smaller miles to play, less wastage, all of those kinds of things. We've got a lot of people that move around the city, and transportation is one of our biggest carbon sinks. So how can we encourage active transport at night in a way that's done safely? Because women don't want to walk down dark roads on their own. And, you know, if you've been to a pub for a few, you might not want to get on a bike afterwards in case you fall off it. So there's so many different complex areas. But but there's a lot of good work going on in sustainability within nightlife settings, and particularly within the festivals industry and the food industry. So I'd like to try and pull some of that knowledge together so that we can have, you know, a citywide effort in how nightlife tackles some of the bigger problems in the world. So we're just trying to solve the climate crisis, misogyny, you know, harm reduction, mental health, just the small thing.
This has been Season 1, Episode 21 of 24 Minutes from 24 Hour Nation. Learn more about us at 24hournation.com and on social media at 24 Hour Nation.